Our final presentation of the session, Effective Variety and Environmental Variables on Verticillium Wilt in the Southern High Plains of Texas, Terry Wheeler, Texas A&M AgriLife Research.
The last one. Well, Verticillium Wilt is a fairly important disease in the Southern High Plains of Texas. It infests, I would guess somewhere around maybe 50% of our fields to some extent or another. It's a fungus that survives very well in our semi-arid environment in our fairly dry soils. The black specks at the bottom are pictures of microsclerotia on a stem. And where I monitor fields, the fungus persists in the soil even in the absence of cotton for many years. The infection occurs or can occur early in the season, though there's a wide window for infection can occur. Eventually it moves systemically up the plant, so typically flowering or usually even closer to early August, we'll start to see some symptoms at the bottom of the plant, and they're slowly going to work their way, the chlorosis on the leaves and whatnot, up to the top. At some point we may see defoliation. If you were to break the stem, you'd see the brown discoloration in the stems. The management recommendations that we have are to use partially resistant varieties, crop rotation with non-hosts, appropriate irrigation rate, and planting at least 4 seed per foot of row, and that's with 40-inch centers. The number one, partially resistant varieties, is kind of a moving target. We run a screening program every year because the new varieties are constantly coming in the market. And I'm going to do the first part of the talk. I'm going to focus on that. Number three, using an appropriate irrigation rate is something that isn't well enough established yet. So we're starting to collect some data to try to understand what that means, an appropriate irrigation rate. So the Verticillium Wilt trials that we run every year, we typically go to 5 to 6 locations. They are sites with a history of the disease. They're grower sites. I use 32 entries per site, 4 applications, randomized complete block design. The plots are 2 rows wide, about 35 to 36 foot long. We measure plant stand on both rows. We count every plant. We count the number of plants that have wilt symptoms on both rows. We do it several times during the season. We look at the defoliation percentage in September, and then we measure yield. This is an example of just one site, Plainview. This is the 32 entries on the x-axis, and on your y-axis is yield. You can see in this case the companies are color-coded. Blue is the Fibromax Stoneville varieties, green is Delta Pineland, red is Next Gen Americot, your red hatched is Experimental Lines from Next Gen, yellow is Phytogen, yellow and black hatched is Experimental Lines from Phytogen, purple is Cropland Genetics, black is Altex or Dynagrove varieties, and black hatched is their Experimental Lines labeled as CT. And you can see kind of as I've ranked them, highest yielding to lowest yielding in this field. The wilt was pretty good in this field. It came in strong by the end of July, so we had, I believe, around a 40% incidence of wilt by the end of July, which is quite early for us. You can see in this case the top yielding one was a red variety that happens to be Next Gen 4111 RF. Then we had a series of 4 blue varieties, which would all be Fibromax or Stoneville. And then we had an Altex Nitro, and so on and so on. We include 4 checks at each of our sites. Fibromax 2484 B2 Flex is my resistant check. Fibromax 9180 B2 Flex is an older resistant check that's been around for quite a while, not quite as good yield-wise as the 2484. And then as a susceptible check, I use Delta Pine 0912 B2 Flex, which is a very high yielding variety in much of the high plains, as long as you don't have wilt. And then a poor yielding variety overall is Americot 1504 B2 Flex, and one that just is devastated by wilt. So those are included at all sites. So that's an example of one test site. Here's where we look at the incidence of wilt, in this case on 30 July, and compare it with the yield, and you can see a reasonably good correlation. wilt incidents where you've got a fair amount of wilt, you have pretty poor yields at this site. Looking at percent defoliation, a little bit poor correlation, but still significant. And again, where you have more defoliation, you tend to have lower yields. Now, this is where I've combined the data across all the sites. And to do this, I use a relative indicator. So at each site, I take the highest yield, and I divide all the yields by the highest average yield. For whatever variety did the best at that site, I divide everything by that number at that site. With wilt, whatever had the worst wilt, I divide all the wilt ratings by that worst wilt. With defoliation, same thing. So everything's on a 0 to 1 scale, with either the worst wilt or the best yield being the 1. And then I do a mixed analysis across all the sites. And not every variety is at every site. Every variety, we try to have at least 3 sites, is typically what it is, other than the checks. And so here's a ranking or an average, least square means average for the 5 sites. And you can see the best variety in this case, you've got a Fibromax 2484 B2 Flex, our resistant check. But you can see of the top entries, you've got a lot of blues in there. You have the red NextGen 4111 RF. So you can get a sense of which companies at this point have the most competitive varieties overall in a Versalene wilt situation. If you look at the relative wilt versus the relative yield, you can see a fairly nice correlation. So your worst relative wilt variety, which would be close to 1, is losing about 49% of the yield that you would expect in a situation like that. So pretty dramatic yield decreases. If we look at defoliation, a little bit less of a relationship, but still quite significant. And again, you can see overall relative defoliation is a reasonably good indicator of what your yield potential is as well. The data is published. Jason Woodward put it out, puts it on the web every year, and so this is the website where we have the individual results for the 5 trials as well as the combined analysis for the wilt, defoliation, yield, etc. So the second part of the presentation is looking at some of these environmental variables and the microscrochia density in the soil. To see if we can do a better job predicting wilt incidents, yield. Ultimately, I would like to have a way to advise producers when they're really at high risk for wilt, where they might be able to manage their irrigation to reduce that risk to some extent. But we've got a lot of data collection to do before we're that far along. So what I've done is I've got a data set of 34 data sets. Let's see, there's 15 of them come from one field that's a research field where we have a series of large plot tests with different irrigation rates, different crop rotations, etc. And this is over 2 years, 2012 and 2013. The other data sets that make up this total of 34 data sets are producer fields all over the High Plains, different irrigation rates, different soil pressures of verticillium, just a wide spectrum of conditions. And what I'm trying to do is look at soil temperature and soil moisture as something a grower could measure to give him an indication when he's at risk. And so I'm just here showing over time from the 15th of July to the end of August at weekly intervals what the relationship was between soil moisture and soil temperature at these 34 in these 34 data sets. So you can see over time, the 15th of July is on your left upper, and then it just goes weekly. By the time you get to the 5th of August to the 11th of August, your R-squares are actually quite good relationships between soil temperature and soil moisture. But we've got quite a range of temperatures and moisture values at these different sites. Also looking at just the relationship between the soil microsclerosis density in these 34 data sets and wilt incidents. So it's a significant relationship, as you can see here. And again, a wide range of values, and these are square root transformed values. Now, what I've done here is use the models. At each week where we have this temperature, soil moisture, the temperature data is in red, the red blocks, the soil moisture is blue, The triangles that are black are where we've looked at a model of an interaction between microscorrhoza density and soil temperature. Now, the first 2 weeks in July, we didn't get much of a relationship, and then we started seeing a pretty good relationship, significant at 0.05 for each of the variables of either soil moisture, soil temperature, or the interaction. So these are the R-square values. By the third week in July, we were significant for soil moisture, or by the second week in July for soil moisture. By the third week, we're significant for soil temperature, soil moisture. But our R-square for the interaction of microscorrhoza and soil temperature is almost 0.8 by the third week in July. And you can see the triangles are by far the best fit where we're combining both soil temperature and microscorrhoza density and using it to predict wilt. These are all significant at 0.05, each of the variables, and our R-squares are about 0.7 for the rest of summer, which is very, very good predictive values, where we combine both soil temperature and microscorrhoza density. This is just looking at the incidence of wilt across these 34 data sets and lint yield. Okay, no correlation, no relationship across this wide range of data. This is looking at microscorrhoza density and lint yield. Okay, we're doing pretty good with wilt. We can predict wilt. Now we're interested in yield. Well, microscorrhoza density by itself isn't predicting yield. If we look at the relationship between soil temperature or soil moisture, and I also looked at it for interactions with microscorrhoza density, we do have a relationship with soil temperature and soil moisture and yield. We do not for microscorrhoza density. We don't have it for an interaction between microscorrhoza density and soil temperature or soil moisture. So our environmental variables are predictors of yield, where you have lower temperatures, you have higher yields, wetter soil, you have higher yields. But our vert factors are not predicting yield in these verticillium wilt fields. So, best varieties, top 12%, listed here, Fibromax 2484, B2 Flex, Fibromax 2322 GL, which is new in 2014, Fibromax 9170 B2 Flex, Stoneville 4747 GL B2, also new in 2014, NextGen 4111 RF, and Fibromax 2989 GL B2. Combined analysis across our five test sites, that was the best group. Our ability to predict wilt, this is the model statement, microscorrhoza with a square root transformation, temperature minus temperature times microscorrhoza with a square root transformation minus microscorrhoza. And so we had a quadratic relationship with microscorrhoza and the interaction with temperature and microscorrhoza. Across a number of weeks, that was an excellent predictor for wilt. With yield, all we could do was use either soil temperature or soil moisture, and whether the field was drip irrigated or center pivot irrigated. Otherwise, we didn't improve our yield prediction with wilt or microscorrhoza density or any of those kind of factors. So we've got some work to do in terms of wilt because we've got, the more you irrigate it, you're higher your yield, but you also are increasing your wilt as you irrigate more. And so there's these opposing factors affecting yield. With wilt, it's pretty straightforward. The wetter the soil is, the cooler the soil is, the more fungus you have in the soil, the more wilt you have. So we're all right with wilt, but we're still not there with yield, and which is ultimately what we have to do to recommend to these farmers to reduce their irrigation at certain times to improve their yields. Because we've got the data that shows within a field, when you overwater, you reduce your yields. You don't increase them. In wilt fields, as the wilt gets worse, you reduce your yields. But we're not in a predictive sense yet where we can do that to any producer. So that should be it. Any questions?
Time for questions.
Yes, sir.
What?
Okay. Well, I've keyed in cultivar as well as resistant or susceptible, and most of the data sets are resistant. But the ones in our research sites, at least we have both resistant and susceptible. Virtually all the producer fields are resistant cultivars. You know, I've looked at the data a number of ways, and I'm trying to keep it broad. We've got data sets where we have high pressure and low water now because the pumping capacities have dropped. We've got fields with high pressure and high water. We've got fields that are just coming up and developing problems. So the numbers, the microscrosh are fairly low, but the pumping capacities are good. I've tried to keep it broad because I've tried to keep it broad. So I don't know if I could take a subset and improve the prediction of yield. I suspect so, but I guess from a utility standpoint, if we're going to use it as an extension, I think we need to be broad.
Well, I think if you want to make a decision mechanism for mm-hmm. the grower, somehow you have to separate out the moisture temperature effects on wilt from the moisture temperature effects on yield potential
yeah.
of your crop.
Yeah. Well, really, what I've done is I've gone to each of these, I've looked at the variability of the data and the temperature, and I've got a little arrow. I didn't put that in. I thought I had. But I've got a little arrow that says, okay, at this temperature, we got no wilt across this data set. And so it typically varies from about 79 to 81 degrees, depending on what week it is in the summer. So typically when we're between 79 and 81 degrees, from that point higher, we get no more wilt or no severe wilt. Everything's really low. So I'm trying to actually identify if there's just some critical temperatures that we can say, okay, for early July, if you're below 79 degrees, your wilt risk is going up and going up pretty fast. And if you're above, your wilt risk is going down. And because it does seem to be that there's only a couple degrees there that we just, all the points beyond that are all real low. And those are hot soils. It's not that they don't have pressure, but they're hot soils. I mean, they're limited in their irrigation, most likely. So that's kind of where I'm looking at it, but I'm still not, I've got to build a model where you have yield in the absence of disease and then the reduction in the presence of disease based on temperature. Somehow I've got to build some sort of a linked model that accounts for both your positive effects of heavy watering and more yield, but the negative effects of disease. I haven't found any yet. Yeah, I know that's. I have not found those temperature data sets yet. But that's clearly, and I do have pumping capacity for these fields, and so that may be an easier one because some of these growers do know their pumping capacities. So anyway, yes, sir, Kenny.
And you may have said this, and I missed it. On the soil moisture levels that you're looking at, is that all through center pivot irrigator? Does that include drip?
There are some center pivots. There's a few drip fields. Right. There are some drip. And drip and that water component, whether it was center pivot versus drip, was a significant factor for yield. That was highly significant. So our drip fields tend to give you a higher yield, but they also, our drip is subsurface. So the soils are actually quite hot near the top. And so they actually provide some interesting data points for that reason. We have less wilt, but we have higher yield capacity because the top of the soil, the top 4 inches, is really quite hot on those fields. Well, I can do the modeling. There's not that many of those fields, so I can take out those two or three or four fields, whatever it is. I guess I could. I just don't think that's as big of a deal. Plus, it gives me the ability to have high yield potential with still pretty hot fields. Hot soils. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Nothing else. That's good. Thanks, Harry, and the rest of our speakers for being on time today.